just giving him the strength.
Apologize, Counselor. I lost my sheet for today, but here it is. We now call the second case, 97-1489 CR, State v. Brandt. Mr. Swank.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Dean Strang. I represent Michael Brandt. Michael Brandt pled guilty without understanding the elements of the offenses to which he was pleading. I said not understanding them, it was not an intelligent plea, because on the record of that plea hearing, the elements of those offenses, the nature of the charges, were not intelligible. This court may look at that as a fundamental due process violation, hearkening back to Boykin and Bangert and Garcia Van Camp from just two terms ago, and that's the view that I prefer. This court, though, also might look at that as a violation of Section 971.08, sub 1, sub A, which instructs that the trial court must, and I'm quoting now, determine that the plea is made voluntarily with understanding of the nature of the charge. In either event, whether one simply looks at this as directly a due process problem, or looks first at the statutory procedures that are not themselves constitutionally mandated, but our intended, Bangert tells us, to assure that the court, in taking a guilty plea, will reach its constitutional goal. In either event, Brandt made the prima facie showing in the Kenosha County Circuit Court that should have required the state then to go forward with evidence, if indeed there would be evidence, that by clear and convincing showing, his guilty plea in fact was understanding, that it was intelligent, that he understood the nature of the charges, which I think all agree here is a core requisite of the Due Process Clause. What happened, though, here, in very practical terms, is at the plea hearing, at the change of plea hearing, Mr. Brandt tendered to the circuit court affirmative evidence that he misunderstood the essential nature of the offenses on a form, a plea hearing form, that the circuit court chose to require and that the circuit court otherwise used.
Let me ask you, so that I understand about the form, is the guilty no contest plea form. What you're referring to, unless I'm wrong, you're referring to it is a handwritten addendum which has on top jury instructions. Is this a required form that there would be a handwritten addendum, or are you talking about the actual plea questionnaire and waiver of rights? Which are you talking about, so I understand?
Justice Wilcox, you're right in describing the addendum. There is a place on the plea hearing form itself, I think it's page one of the form itself, that provides some lines to lay out the elements of the offense.
And it says, see attached.
The lawyer apparently didn't have enough room, and there isn't much room there, particularly if we're talking about more than one count. So the lawyer writes, scribbles, see attached, and we have the addendum there.
What you would be asking this court is that in this, that the court would then be required to review the, as they do, the jury instructions, or as we call them, the elements. And if there was a, and when I read this a couple of days ago, I said, you know, this, I thought when you said unintelligible, basically I find it difficult to read this. I mean, just read it from the sense of, because it's, I shouldn't say its handwriting is worse than mine, but it's similar to mine, and that's one of the difficulties. And I think the judge, Wilk, said, well, I have the elements here. These are the three charges. And he read those to your client, and your client heard those elements, and then, of course, he answered that he was guilty, no contest to those elements. So he heard the correct elements. What you're saying is that because there was a mistake in the plea questionnaire, that is a fatal defect. Even though the judge read the correct elements, and that should...
I am saying that here.
So what I'm asking is that what effect, if the judge now is bound either to say these elements are correct, or I have read these, Judge Will took the position that he was not required. In other words, he had read the correct elements, and I think, as I recall, some of my trial experience in 13 years, that there is a handbook out there, at least I thought, that you have all the elements, and so when you have this come up, you read that to the defendant that appears before you.
The problem here is, it starts earlier. Judge Will made a decision to require plea questionnaires. This was a plea questionnaire, as many but not all in this state, 72 counties do, required laying out the elements of the offense. Having made the decision optionally, but making the decision all the same, to use and to require plea questionnaires, and then incorporating that into the plea process, on those facts, I do think it was incumbent upon the judge to look at the form and to correct any misinformation that went to the heart of the voluntariness inquiry. Now, had the plea questionnaire never been there, which is an available option under Bangert, there presumably would have been no misinformation to correct. And the colloquy looked at in isolation was fine on the recitation of the elements of defense to which Brandt pled. The difficulty is that there was irreconcilable information on this record, and the judge simply let that irreconcilable information, that state of confusion, stand uncorrected.
Counsel, I'm somewhat confused. On page appendix 5, which is the appended jury instructions, which sets forth three crimes. And then on page appendix 17, the court accepts the pleas and adjudges the defendant guilty of forgery in violation of
943-38-1A.
Right?
Yes.
But on appendix 5, that's the citation, 943-38-1A. What's the matter with that?
The problem here is that on the addendum, counsel is referring to a falsely written check.
Right.
Which would have been count 3 of the information. Count 3 was dismissed.
All right.
Count 1 concerned a forged loan application.
So that was just, it's the citation to the statute is okay. It's the 123 under.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, the statute, for that one, yes, the statutory citation is correct.
Right. And then the second one is 943-20-1D, and then I can't read what the rest of it is, but the judge found him guilty of 1D3C. And I gather this doesn't fit the facts of the case either, is that it?
Well, the charge in the information in count 2, in fact, was 1D. Now, there should be a comma. 3C is the penalty provision of the statute. Counsel here again has written the correct statute number,
right.
but now he's loused up the elements. The elements laid out under count 2 are in fact not the elements of the violation at 1D.
All right, so it looks
like it's 1C, but it's wrong in any event.
counsel.
And the same thing by uttering, they don't have a citation to a, that's on the second page,
right.
Which is the third count.
Right.
And under the judge's finding, it's 943.382, and I gather this is not 943.382. Is that right?
The word uttering correctly describes the crime in count five. These are not the elements of uttering. These are the elements of possession of a forged check or document with intent to utter.
All right. How does that happen?
Defense counsel was human. I mean, he simply blew it. If one goes to the pattern criminal jury instructions, for instance, on count five, one of these is 1492 and the other one's 1493.
Oh, just picked the wrong.
They're close.
Okay.
He just went to the wrong one. I
can easily happen. Right. Okay. Just wanted to check that.
The factual understanding that I hope to leave the court with is that the elements described in the addendum referred to by incorporation in the plea questionnaire were wrong. They were all wrong, all three offenses, the elements. The elements that Judge Wilk read in court were right down the line.
Was there anything wrong with that? Okay, he read the elements. Was there anything else wrong with the colloquy that Judge Wilk held with your client other than the addendum, erroneous information?
There were. There aren't things that we've challenged on which I rely here. But for instance, Judge Wilk did not, in his colloquy, go through all of the constitutional rights that were being waived. Judge Wilk never referred to the portion of 971.08 that requires advice about the potential deportation consequences if the pleading accused is an alien. So there were failings in the colloquy if one looked at it. One would not use this as a textbook example in doing a plea. It's harmless to Brandt. It's not an issue here.
Would one look at this as a textbook example with regard to how a judge should ask the question about the elements, set forth the elements, and then follow up with a question regarding whether or not they understood, the defendant understood the elements? I note that the judge here said, and I'm picking just count five on page 13 of the appendix, you understand by pleading guilty to the crime of uttering, count five, you are admitting you committed all of the elements of that crime, which are as follows, sets forth the elements, and then follows up after finishing the elements, do you understand that you are admitting you are committing all the elements of that crime? Is that a textbook example of how to preface the elements, give the elements, and then conclude the elements?
I wouldn't write or buy that textbook, but it's acceptable.
What's wrong with it?
If there's something wrong with this colloquy, it is...
I'm just talking about with regard to the elements.
I understand, and I'm referring to the same, Justice Bradley. You couldn't say that Judge Wilk is engaged in a perfunctory exercise there, but the answers are perfunctory from the defendant. They don't give us much. The defendant is being led and giving, I think, fairly perfunctory responses. The questions are right. They're adequate.
Okay.
What type of answers? Excuse me. Did you complete it? Okay. What type of answers when you say they were perfunctory, and that is yes and no, I understand perfunctory, but what else are you expecting your client to say? I mean, what when you say that you leave me with the impression something else should be given by your client or someone else in that colloquy when he or she is being asked these questions?
And I don't want to get too far out into the land of the textbook because, again, I'm saying I think this is adequate.
But to follow up with the questions.
Right. I, myself, were I a circuit court judge,
I would want the defendant at some point to tell me in his own words what he did. What is it that you did that makes you guilty here? It's a very common, in this state, in either district, almost uniform question that federal judges put to pleading defendants. And that's where I would want it. I would want to loosen this up and inject some real language into this, as opposed to a recitation of elements out of a jury instruction or a benchmark.
You want a response from the elicited from the defendant that, in the vernacular, acknowledges understanding of the elements. Is that what you're saying? No, but what did you do? Well, let's see. I'm looking again at Appendix 13. On the charge of uttering, or the crime of uttering. Well, let's see. One day I was writing a legal instrument, you know, a piece of paper, and then I guess it was false when I was doing it, and I knew it was false. Is that what you want him to say?
Yes, but Justice Bradley, for the practical purposes of this case and this court's duty, the problem here is not any of this. It is that Judge Wilk did not say, you know, I'm looking at the plea questionnaire that you've given me, Mr. Brandt, and you've got different crimes here entirely that you told me that you're pleading to.
That's what I'm getting at, or trying to get at. It seems to me you are saying then that, in varying degrees, this plea colloquy is fine. No problems. Maybe not textbook from your point of view, but no problems. What you're asking is that this court, anytime there is a plea advisement and waiver of rights form, require the judge to carefully review it and to assess its accuracy or inaccuracy, and if it's inaccurate, to correct it on the record. That's what this case is about. Am I right or wrong?
I think that's fair. I think I am asking if there is... The defendant has now tendered affirmative evidence that he misunderstands the elements of the crimes to which he's pleading. That's there before the judge. The judge has got the plea hearing, the plea questionnaire. The judge is using it, at least selectively. And yes, I am saying, if you're going to use it, then use it.
I mean, judge here said... you can say the judge here corrected any problem because he said these are the elements, and do you understand the elements, and do you realize that you're admitting to these elements? That's what the record says, standing alone. But you're saying he needs more than to have a colloquy. He needs to go forward with cleaning up any errors that exists in the plea advisement form.
That's what the transcript says, standing alone. The record here has crimes A, B, and C, and crimes D, E, and F, and that's what never was reconcilable or reconciled. So I mean, if this were an accounting system and we simply treated a human as an accounting unit and we were going to adopt a last in, first out method of accounting, that would probably be fine, but the reality is that this man signed the plea agreement, the plea questionnaire that morning, saying, yeah, I understand these are the elements to which I'm pleading. He comes in later and says, irreconcilably, no, I understand that these are the elements to which I'm pleading, and that's got to be corrected. If the circuit court is the sponsor of this form and it's there, it's part of the proceeding and the record, that's got to get corrected. You know, had I filed a brief in this case that was at polar contradiction with the argument I'm standing here making now, the natural sequence of good judgment from the seven justices here would be to say, Mr. Strang, we're confused. What do you really mean? In writing you say this, and here in oral argument you say something else. And those two things we can't reconcile. So take a minute, pull yourself together, Mr. Strang, or, you know, let's do something to straighten it out. And that's not, you know, I understand the circuit judge is but one and there are seven here, but that's not too much to ask a circuit judge who has required that this one or two or three page form be used.
Well, now, what's the purpose of the form? As I understood it, the purpose, one purpose, I may be wrong, was that it's really the attorney's obligation to explain the plea, explain the elements, explain the consequences. Attorney, that's what the attorney is there for, and that the court should be sure it was done, but it's counsel's obligation. And this questionnaire is a way of reminding counsel and client to do that. And then the court can rely on that in the hearing. That's what I understood. Is that right?
And reliance is fine. Blind reliance is not.
But is that the purpose of the form?
Sure, it's to facilitate. It's to see that the separate Sixth Amendment duties of counsel are performed, so we don't run into a problem there. But the due process, the 14th Amendment duty, rests squarely on the trial court and doesn't move from there.
So what do you want? If you were writing the opinion, what do you want? Do you want the court to say that where a questionnaire and waiver of rights form is completed, that the judge should review that to make sure that it is consistent with the court testimony, or that it doesn't have any difficulties? I mean, what is your bottom line?
That would be the second thing I want. The first thing I would ask is this: that this opinion say that Bangor meant what it said when it said that we are not concluded under Chikin, we are no longer going to be concluded by the plea transcript. Voluntariness as a constitutional matter need not appear on the transcript, but it must be there under the totality of the circumstances. I would flip it around, I would say that's a two-way street. And when involuntariness is there on the full record of the plea proceeding, that a formally acceptable colloquy or a transcript okay in form will not conclude the inquiry, and the involuntariness of the plea will not be overlooked. Second would be, if you're going to use it, as the Chief Justice said.
All right. And here, where let's say you get over the first hurdle, but then you get into the totality, the situation where we're looking at the whole situation, and you have a judge who disregards and does not mention at all the addendum that you filed, simply goes over the charges and then states the elements and then asks the client, your client, how he pleads. What you're saying is that should be disregarded because the fatal defect has been made by not checking the addendum.
Not disregarded.
Well,
but regarded not as conclusive where the full record of that plea hearing reflects misinformation that goes to the core of the voluntariness inquiry. Regarded, but not regarded as conclusive, where there's right here in the record evidence that the defendant misunderstands and has been misinformed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kleinmeier, Assistant Attorney General representing the plaintiff respondent, State of Wisconsin.
Yes, may it please the court, I'm Stephen Kleinmeier, Assistant Attorney General, appearing for the State of Wisconsin, the plaintiff respondent. And I think just as Bradley stated, what I think is the issue in this case, and that is whether the trial judge, even when the judge correctly defines the elements of the crime, is still going to be obligated to go and check the correctness of the plea questionnaire, see if what was written up by the attorney is also correct. I don't think that should be obligation. Bangor, the court said, the trial court is supposed to establish the defendant understands the nature of the crime, the elements of the crime. The trial court can do it by one or a combination of methods, and among the methods listed were the trial court himself or herself summarizing the elements of the crime, which is what the trial court did here. The trial court can also ask the defense attorney, Have you discussed the elements with your client? And if you did, how did you describe, what did you explain to your client? And the other one is the trial court can look at some other part of the record or some written statement of some kind to see if the defendant has been advised, which I think it could also could be the plea questionnaire. It seems to me the trial court made the selection here. The trial court chose to summarize the elements himself, and the defendant admits that they were summarized correctly. I think when the trial court did that, the trial court satisfied the court's decision in Bangor, it satisfied its statutory requirements under Section 97108, it satisfied constitutional requirements to establish the plea was voluntary, knowing, and understanding as to the elements. I don't think the trial court should then be required to go on and check the plea questionnaire to see if it was correct in regard to what the trial court has already just discussed with the defendant. Frankly, I don't understand at that point. It seems to me the defendant is saying, I didn't understand the plea, the elements, because the trial court told me one thing, the written plea questionnaire told me something else. I don't know why that would be limited to the written plea questionnaire. If inconsistent advice constitutes confusion for the defendant, then that would seem to apply to information in plea questionnaires, whether the court used the plea questionnaire or not, whether it was oral advice given by the attorney the morning of the trial or before. Either way, if he's getting inconsistent advice, it's inconsistent. It seems to me when the trial court has satisfied this obligation, when it correctly defines the elements and says, do you understand? That's the defendant's opportunity, because he's confused, to point out the confusion and let the judge explain. The defendant in this case admits, I wasn't paying attention. If he wasn't paying attention, where's the confusion?
In our next case, there's a confusion or disagreement about what language means. And it just seems to me that if you can really show different elements to which the defendant now has pled, agrees that he can plead guilty, it really does raise a question about his understanding. I mean, the example that Mr. Strang gave is correct. If you argued off brief, that is something that you disagreed with in your brief, I would assume somebody in this court would say, hey, there's a conflict. Which is your argument? I mean, you might say there's no conflict. You might say you're arguing in the alternative, or you might say I'm withdrawing the brief, withdrawing the oral argument. But surely there's a question about what the understanding is.
In this case,
and surely there's a question as to the advice counsel gave in what was happening, where counsel inadvertently, and we did something we all can do, just plugged in the wrong instructions.
And I have a two-part response that I think in the situation, as far as the inconsistent briefs, and the court asking the question, it's flipped around. The defendant was getting inconsistent advice. He should be then saying, I'm confused. I was told two different things. What's right? He didn't express any confusion when he was court advised him. And the other thing is, as far as the attorney's incorrect advice, perhaps, and as stated point on this brief, the defendant should not be blaming the trial court here and saying, the trial court should have checked the plea questionnaire. Perhaps the claim should be moved to withdraw the plea on grounds of ineffective assistance of counsel, because counsel was the one who gave the incorrect advice. Second counsel was the one who misadvised the court in the afternoon when the court asked counsel, have you gone over the plea questionnaire with the defendant? Yes. Are you satisfied the plea is being entered knowingly and voluntarily? Yes. The attorney didn't point out the inconsistency either. And now you may say, well, the defendant is not going to know the subtle differences in the elements. Well, certainly his attorney should. And the attorney is portraying to the court that everything is consistent and fine.
And wasn't this a substitute attorney?
Yes.
Who knew, one would assume, a limited amount about the case.
But he advised the court that the court asked him, have you discussed this with your client? And the attorney said, yes. I mean, and as far as we've, I'm not sure, it seems to me the court, in effect, did examine the plea questionnaire by asking the attorney whether he had gone over it. And it's, I don't think it's too much to expect the attorney to point out inconsistencies if there were some.
Didn't the subsequent affidavit indicate that he misspoke to the court?
I guess that's one word that could be used.
Well, there were others that came to mind, but that's the one I chose. I mean, in other words, didn't the subsequent affidavit indicate that he did not go over the plea questionnaire with the client?
The second attorney, the affidavit from the second attorney, said he in fact had never discussed the case with Mr. Brandt, and he had just appeared with him at the plea hearing.
Well, suppose this were an ineffective assistance of counsel case. How would it differ from the posture of the case now?
Well, a big difference would be that the defendant would obviously have to show his attorney was deficient, and by saying he advised me incorrectly, he may well establish that, but then he has to show prejudice. And in showing prejudice, as pointed out by this court in Bentley, quoting from Hill versus Lockhart, to show prejudice, defendant seeking withdraw his or her plea must allege facts that there is a reasonable probability that but for counsel's errors, he would not have pleaded guilty and would have insisted going on to trial. So the defendant would have to be here saying, even though I didn't pay attention during the plea hearing, had the attorney advised me of the correct elements, I wouldn't have pled guilty. I would have gone to trial. I think he may have a hard time. He may say it, but I think you have to show more than just a statement. You have to show a reasonable basis for that, and I think you may have a very difficult time making that showing.
What does the record show the first attorney did with regard to advising the defendant? Page 7 might have it, I can't remember.
No, I was looking for his affidavit, which I don't believe is attached in this court's brief.
Page 7 of your briefs.
Okay, I'm going directly to the affidavit of the first attorney. He said, I reviewed the plea questionnaire and attached advisory elements to which Mr. Brandt pled guilty in this case. I drafted those documents. I reviewed the questionnaire with Mr. Brandt in my office on the morning of July 25th. He signed the plea questionnaire in my presence. And then he says, I now realize the elements are wrong. I did not realize them at the time.
How much time did he spend with them?
I don't think he says the defendant. Oh, here he says on paragraph 4 of the affidavit, Brandt spent about one half hour in my office to go over the questionnaire. I then had to leave for a jury trial in federal court. And the defendant in his affidavit mentions, I think, that there wasn't a lot of time. Let's see if I can find that. So that morning he went with Mr. Richards. We went through a plea form very quickly, although I don't remember all the details. There's also been a statement made that the judge required the plea form being used here. Now, I haven't found that in the record. I can't say whether or not, as a standard practice, Judge Wilk requires them or not, because I'm not familiar with the practice in this court, but I don't find anything in the record. The only thing in the record about a plea form is that page, this is transcript of document number 21, the plea hearing transcript, starts on page 2, goes to page 3. The defense attorney says, there has been a plea agreement, or plea questionnaire prepared, which, to the extent that tells us anything, almost implies that the attorney did his own. But again, I just point that out, that I don't know if there's anything in the record to show that the court required that form. And I frankly don't see why that would make any difference. Because if the defendant's misunderstanding or lack of knowledge comes from inconsistent advice, that would seem to apply no matter where the source of the attorney's advice came from. Also, I just want to point out that I think the court did, even though it's not a point in this case really, it did advise the court of all the defendant of all the constitutional rights he waived at pages 7 and 8. I think he had all the elements, all the rights that this court set forth in, or cited in Bankard in 131, Wisconsin 2nd at 271 when it cited the special materials. The court here, when it went through with this colloquy and it listed all the elements and then asked the defendant whether he understood that, I mean, what he was doing here, I think that satisfies. The defendant seems to be, has to be bound by his answers to this plea. That was his chance to point out a misunderstanding if he could. And the federal court, in one of the cases we cited, this United States versus DeWalt, gives a standard as to when the judge can know he satisfied his or her obligations to inform the defendant. The standard is, this is in DeWalt, 92 F3rd at page 1212. It says, a court must have a colloquy with the defendant that would lead a reasonable person to believe that the defendant understood the nature of the charge. Seems to me what the court did here certainly satisfies that standard. When he went, the court listed the elements and said, do you understand you're admitting all these? And the defendant says, yes. And that, if the court's going to be required to review all plea questionnaires, regardless of whether the court uses it or what role the court wants to put in it, in effect, is letting the defense attorney dictate which method the court will use to inform the defendant of the elements of the crimes. And Banker said it's the court's option to pick one. The defense attorney, by using plea questionnaires, seems to make it affect dictate which form, which place gets used.
Well, not only that, counsel, one of the things that bothered me with this jury instruction, rather than elements on this, was I just found it hard to read. It's difficult to read the handwriting here, and that it would be, I can see as a trial judge when you're going through it, would be difficult to go through. And there could be a couple words that are wrong that you couldn't even decipher, as there are in this document, that could change the colloquy or be wrong. I think that's another danger, is that then if your sentence was inappropriate or you thought it was, it would give you, well, there's an error there and it wasn't corrected. So it puts the whole burden on the trial court to make sure that that is correct.
And as Chief Justice Iverson asked before, I'm asking where the difference is, where it was wrong. I mean, the error, if there's an error, it may not be always real clear to see. So it may be very reasonable for, especially if you have notes such as these, they might even be more sparsely written than these notes. And how is the trial judge to look at those and then decipher whether they were explained by the attorney, whether they're explained correctly or incorrectly? It's like how is... Under Banger, the court said the defense counsel and the defendant have a role to play in this plea hearing process also. The defense counsel is supposed to explain the elements to his client and the rights that are being waived. Well, if he explains them orally, how is the trial court going to know whether those were explained accurately? In the Van Camp case, which was referred to earlier, my memory of that one was the defense attorney did not use a plea questionnaire. He was asked later what he advised his client, and he couldn't try to recall from memory. And that was found to be insufficient. I mean, it's still not where you would draw the line as to what the trial court is supposed to be checking on. I think that covered the points I had to cover.
Well. Thank you. Then what is the bottom line, or what is the rule of law you want this opinion to state?
The trial court has shown, well, I think the standard in this DeWalt case is helpful because it shows when the trial court would know that he or she's completed his or her duty as far as establishing it. And so when the trial court completes the colloquy on the nature of the elements or any other points that the court has covered, then the court's completed its duties. It doesn't have to check the plea questionnaire to see if there's a conflict. Now, if you had a situation where, as I think some trial courts maybe do, is they rely almost extensively exclusively on the plea questionnaire to fill in all of it, then, of course, the trial court better be checking to make sure it's correct. But when a trial court covers the matter, him or herself, and covers it correctly, then I think, and the defendant says he understands, and I think a reasonable person can conclude that the defendant does understand, and the court's completed, doesn't have to go behind that colloquy, that correct colloquy, to then see if the defendant at some previous point had been given advice that was inconsistent with that. And if the defendant did have some inconsistent advice, his remedy is by claiming ineffective assistance of counsel.
Counsel, does the record indicate whether or not this defendant can read?
I don't know unless I suspect, my guess is there's something in the plea questionnaire, but I haven't been to look at the questionnaire.
Yeah, the plea questionnaire is not checked, and then it says, I have read, parentheses, or have read to me. Or have read to me is underlined, but number 13 is not checked, which I'm just wondering, are we to take the line underneath or have read to me means that it was read to him rather than he reading?
Because
there any clarification in the
record? I was just checking Mr. Brandt's affidavit to see if there's any indication.
That's
there.
14 years of school, if I read it correctly, that he had.
Well, I know it's also in the record that he's a businessman and operates some businesses. So, I mean, his business success or operations that indicate that he can.
You think that they were crossing out the words rather than underlining the words, or have had read to me?
Pardon me?
Well, I'm looking at 13, and you can say what has happened is they underlined the words "or have had read to me," which would make me think that that's what happened.
I note underneath, the attorney says, has circled, "I read the questionnaire to the defendant."
Right. Yeah, and I think we could say he read it, but that doesn't necessarily mean the defendant can't read. It could well
be.
I don't think there is anything that says he can't. And I suspect the attorney, I think it's probably good for the attorney to read it and make sure that the client is aware of everything there, that the client hasn't skipped over
Do
something.
Do the affidavits indicate that the attachment, the handwritten elements, was read to? Is there anything that addresses that? Since we have in the record that the questionnaire itself was read.
Well, I think it's a little ambiguous because the affidavit of, of Mr. Richards, the first attorney, said, I have reviewed the plea questionnaire and attached evaluating elements to which Mr. Brandt pled guilty in this case. I drafted those documents. I reviewed the questionnaire with Mr. Brandt in my office. Brandt signed the plea questionnaire in my presence. So at the beginning of that paragraph, he distinguishes between the plea questionnaire and the attached evaluating elements. And when he talks about what you reviewed with Mr. Brandt, he only mentions the questionnaire.
Yes.
And the affidavit of Mr. Brandt is, when he appeared for court in the afternoon, he met Attorney Reister. He says, "We had no discussion about the plea process or plea questionnaire. I remember him handing me a piece of paper which I signed. I believe this to be the outline of the elements of defenses which ultimately was submitted to the plea questionnaire," which would indicate that he certainly didn't sign that in the morning when he met with the first attorney. But when he was advised of those, it's not exactly clear.
Okay, Mr. Kleinmeier, thank you. Mr. Strang, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Can you clarify that issue of reading versus have read?
On the record? That's an example where the actual colloquy in court didn't address it. As I recall, the colloquy in court, there isn't any exploration of how much education you have. You know, do you understand what I'm saying? Do you read and write the English language? I think the plea questionnaire covered all of that. Tacitly, Judge Wilk is relying there on the plea questionnaire to supplement his colloquy, just as he did when in the colloquy he happens to omit the jury unanimity requirement, if I'm recollecting correctly, but that is there in the plea questionnaire.
Counsel, I also note in the plea questionnaire, it's dated July 25th, 1996. Is that the correct date? And that the... That's not the correct date.
And let's don't get hung up on that, Justice. The date is exactly 2 months off, and I have no explanation for why one says May and the other one July. There is no dispute that the plea questionnaire, in fact, was reviewed, filled out, and signed the morning of the guilty plea. When I step back from this, at least as I understand Bangert, the heart of it is that substance will prevail over form. That it's substance, it's the actual voluntariness with which we are concerned, not a litany of formal rights or an inquiry that's merely concluded against the trial judge by what the judge happens to have said at the plea colloquy as reflected in the transcript. And if that's good reasoning, as I think it is fundamentally, then it works both ways. The substance here is that this record shows, and that was available to Judge Wilk, evidence of misunderstanding in the form of a botched plea questionnaire and addendum. And Judge Wilk's complaint was not that I couldn't read it. His holding at the post-conviction hearing was, I don't have a duty to closely peruse that. And in my experience, defense counsel often do these inartfully. Well, and again, I'm not urging the court to establish a rule that abstractly mandates a duty to review a plea questionnaire. I am asking the court to stick with the totality of the circumstances reasoning that Bangert brought in overruling Shikini in part, and to hold that where the circuit judge is confronted with, on the record, evidence of misunderstanding that would go to involuntariness, there is an obligation because of the overarching duty here to assure a voluntary plea to explore and rectify that. A confused person may or may not know that he ought to speak up, but in effect, Brandt told the judge, I'm confused, by tendering in writing something that reflected the confusion. And while just as some civil plaintiffs might elect to bring a breach of contract claim rather than a tort action, Mr. Brandt elected to bring a claim rooted in due process seeking withdrawal of his plea, and elected not to bring an ineffective assistance claim. That was available to him. That is, this has always been a claim that the plea was involuntary and ought to be withdrawn. We haven't shifted ground on that. Regardless of what remedy we might also, or alternatively, or separately have sought, we never have raised an ineffective assistance claim here. And this court has been very, very clear, as has the United States Supreme Court, that it is a trial court's duty to assure voluntariness of a plea. And if there has been a constitutional deprivation in that regard, the guilty plea is the defendant's to withdraw of right. Never has the court wavered from that. Never have we altered the grounds on which this claim is rooted. So what I'm asking this court to do in the end is to remand this case to find, under a de novo standard, that the prima facie showing was made. And on remand, the state would bear the burden of proving voluntariness, if it could.
Thank you, Mrs. Strang. Thank you, Mr. Kleinmeier. That ends 97-1489 CR. We are recessed until 1:45, when we'll hear the last case for the February arguments. Thank you.